Welcome to Pat's Labor, a podcast about the anime Pat Labor and Pat's Labor to learn about labor history through the prism of Pat Labor. My name is Tucson Egan.
My name is Clayton.
That was good. That was good. And that concludes our third committee meeting on figuring out whether or not this is a good intro for us. Sorry, I think maybe on the fourth one we'll figure out running order. So, because I noticed on that one I kind of stepped on your intro, Clayton. So you want to go ahead and give us another clean take of that intro?
We're going to do it again. I can do it again if you want me to.
He totally can. He aced it. So
yeah.
And leave all this in, please.
You have to understand that I am literally a total nerd who memorized the V for Vendetta speech by heart in high school. So like,
Did you really?
This is something that I'm good at. Yeah, I can actually.
I did the Independence Day one.
You did? Oh my goodness. Yeah. That's a good one too.
Do we all have the sort of it's not like a Mandela effect, but it's like, I think it was a deliberate distortion of reality that the Wachowskis directed V for Vendetta. I think they tried to make us think that the Wachowskis directed that.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, they did. They did, right?
They didn't direct it.
What? They wrote it, right?
Maybe they wrote it.
I think.
I mean, it was based on an Alan Moore comic, right?
Yeah.
V for Vendetta movie. Yeah, directed by James McTeague.
What?
Director of
screenplay.
Yeah, because they really like pumped up the fact of it being a screenplay by the Wachowskis and produced by the Wachowskis. It was all but a Wachowski movie. But it's not. It's a James McTeague movie. Oh man,
they tricked us.
They tricked us. But we're not talking about V for Vendetta. We're talking about Pat's Labor, the anime Pat Labor, and Pat's Labor to learn about labor history through the prism of Pat Labor.
Did it again.
Thank you.
Also, Pat, you haven't introduced your name yet.
Yeah, I'm Patrick Gill. I'm Pat.
What's your name, Pat?
I'm Pat.
Yeah.
This was a really good app.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a really, really good episode.
Yeah, I was saying before that, like, I had watched that first episode years ago when I think in 2015 or 2016, I was just getting into a lot more Gundam anime, and I remembered liking it, and I don't know if it was just hard to continue watching it, but it didn't hit me. Maybe I wanted more mecha action. Mm-hmm. But now, returning to this and watching the second episode, I'm so excited to continue watching this series. It is... Yeah. Exactly my kind of stuff now.
The great thing about the beginning of this episode is the loop it throws you for, because I was like, oh, I thought that this isn't, it does a thing in the beginning of the episode that was like, I thought that this is exactly what Pat Labor
was. Yes. It does the super robot pan over of Alphonse, and I'm just like, that's Pat Labor, but that's not Pat Labor as I understand it.
The robot looks too big and shiny.
It looks too big, too exotic, too interesting like that.
It's got these big wings, which they point out. But the first thing that I cued in on that I was like, oh, that's ridiculous. But wait a minute. Was that they were hauling out the revolvers and they were the size of cars. And it's like, okay, I know they're big, but damn, they're big. And it just didn't cue in on yet that, like, actually everything's scale is distorted right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this episode of Pat Labor starts with a fake out sequence where the mobile
What's
unit
the name
is,
of the episode?
Long Shot.
Episode is Long Shot. They are being summoned to go deal with a urgent crime. And as they're prepping the Pat Labor, which is, again, the patrol labor, the... essentially anthropomorphized police car that these cops run around in Tokyo. It has been upgraded with a massive jetpack and wings. And I wrote down this line because it was so funny and so tonally weird. So I was watching the dub version. Mm-hmm. And it's the normally very dour commanding officer saying, it gives us the ability to combat aerial crimes, which will come in the near future. And it's so funny.
There will be crimes in the sky. Like, what?
I think they call it this is the AV2. So they're really like already introduced a new robot, which just feels like another kind of dig at this genre. And then also the way the squad is all lined up in profile feels like the team about to go to each one of their like robots or something. Like, it's great. Mm-hmm. But it is just a little off. And this, it was around this time that she gets in it that I'm like, wait a minute.
It was when they wheeled out the gun. I was just like, there's no fucking
way. You got it right immediately. Yeah,
there's no fucking way. I'm just like, that gun's too expensive. You put that shit back right now. I don't know what you're thinking. I'm just like.
So she gets in it and it starts to like rocket off. Like they open the garage like ceiling, which is mm-hmm. new, and she starts to rocket up, but it barely gets like halfway out of the hangar before it can't lift off, and so it comes back down, and then it's the size is even more emphasized as it looms over and starts to fall forward, only for Izumi to wake up on the floor. She has indeed been in a dream the whole time.
It got me, to be honest. It got me because I've never seen Pat Labor other than the movie that I watched and the first episode that we watched the other week, and it committed enough to this fake out that I was like, I mean, and again, this is a show where in the previous episode, a character got like a 3-minute dressing down for asking to go to the gun range.
Right.
Where he was then explained the process of requisitioning the ammo and booking the range and all of this stuff. And then to have this episode start with a character being surprised that their mech now has wings and being told that they are now going to fly that mech without any training. I was like,
Did they get the money to make the wings and the propulsion system? Who did you have to talk to? Like, this is not something that just happens overnight. It's not that type of mecha show. I'm just like, you have to file paperwork to do this.
So I was really refreshed and excited to see that it was a dream sequence, and I was like, all right, good on you.
Although, and then it's funny because then she's immediately just commuting to work, because now it's like, this is the real world. She was on vacation, she got pulled into this. But I do like that they Asuma is the one who points out that like flying labors, that's ridiculous. We're not going to have those for at least 10 years.
At least 10 years, like, right?
Specifically, he says, it's going to be 10 years before Pat Labors could fly.
Yeah.
Yes, so the thrust of this episode, is that we have a NYPD officer visiting Tokyo. And this is a new character who is going to stick around. And she is coming in advance of a visit from New York City's mayor. To discuss.
This is a tough one because I'm both like greatest city in the world, but it's also ACAB, and it's like, oh.
Yeah. And it's like, but what's the person's name? What's their name?
It's such a good name, honestly. Sergeant Kanuka Clancy.
Kanuka Clancy.
Like NYPD Sergeant Kanuka Clancy. Yeah.
And did somebody Hawaiian immigrant.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Like they point all these things out about her that makes her an intriguing character for a lot of reasons on a show like this, but I couldn't get over the, like, immediately we get a New York reference to like specifically about the mayor, who we never see, which is funny.
We never see the mayor once. Yeah. The mayor's in town to have some lunch with some folks from the Diet. A luncheon, specifically the luncheon, comes up several times, and they are concerned about terrorist attacks.
They're also talking about the Babylon Project,
yes,
which is a very big deal in the first movie, and will probably be mentioned several times throughout this like first season. So yeah,
interesting. It's cool how much
how
much it does become like. Very clear how important it already has been to where the series is, because so the Babylon Project is basically like a giant seawall kind of blocking Tokyo Bay from the ocean, so that they can stop ocean rise. Like they literally reference greenhouse gas problem
from
environmentalism. There are protests because of this gigantic construction going on, worries about its environmental impacts. Also, very specifically, this is a massive construction project. And as we mentioned in the previous episode, the whole reason there are Pat Labors is because there are labors that do construction and other things in the city. And so you need a crime unit that can handle giant robots. So you need a crime unit that has its own giant robots. And they said it's something like 70 to 80% increase of labors in Tokyo because of this construction project. So it is literally linked to why they're...
Of 87, a factor of 87 times
That's...
of of why the labors are such a integral part of this, because it's literally like reshaping Tokyo Bay. And I'm just like, that is a enormous, profound infrastructural undertaking that, boy, I wish we had that kind of imagination in the age 2025, but okay, man, whatever. Not to blow anybody out.
I love me some public works, and that wasn't even on my mind. It was mostly just like, this show is going to such lengths to connect the whole, like, why this, yes, then this, then this, mm-hmm, then this, then this. I was just impressed by that.
It was such a cool moment of, like, Oshii, like, being like, I did think of that. Because on the last episode I brought up, maybe it was episode zero, trying to figure out the sort of escalation between patrol labors and labors. And I was thinking, as like, the framing of the beginning of the show is that, you know, we introduce these things to these, the labors to do labor, mm-hmm, and then the patrol labors to deal with the crime that comes from the result of those. And I was thinking about, like, the escalation between, like, police militarization and, like, the sort of public's ability to do bigger things. And then this episode, it comes right out and says, the reason there are so many labors everywhere and so much crime is because of this massive project that we are doing. And this massive project isn't necessarily popular. Yeah. When they show, like, footage of, like, the protests against it because of environmental concerns, and, like, that they specifically say they're concerned it's going to disrupt sea currents and stuff,
mm-hmm,
like natural things that need to continue. But they show the crowd, and it's a massive crowd of people who don't want this happening.
I'm curious if this is a part where you might launch into something, because I was wondering, this is a late 80s show.
Yeah.
80s, 90s is a large wave of the environmentalist movement, especially like the direct thing they're referencing here, which is kind of surprising. The greenhouse gases and climate change and rising oceans, because I do know that environmental protest is a big thing in Japan. I think it's not often associated with something like this, though.
There is when I saw that scene, it immediately made me think of Giant Robo, The Day the Earth Stood Still, which is a very different giant robot anime than Pat Labor. It very much does not exist within, like, the real robot sort of milieu, but it is also an avowed, like, sort of, like, anti-nuclear, like, like, treaties that talks about, like, alternative clean energy, but also the sort of, like, the dark side of proprietary...
The costs, yeah.
Proprietary and alternate energy sources, so yeah.
And, like, Godzilla is the easy one to go for, and how much that's connected to, like, nuclear stuff, but this, mm-hmm, this idea of, like, something like climate change being, like, this is kind of like set off point for this whole chain of events that leads you to a police unit with giant robots is interesting.
Right. Yeah.
And Clayton, to respond to your prompt, yes, this was in fact something that I looked into and found one interesting article on. Well, okay. I found another interesting article, but we'll save it for later in the episode because it's, ooh, a spoiler and it's not really substantial. it's about blimps.
Wait.
But yeah, I found this article on the Environmental Health News Network, written by Pradnya Garud, who is, let me scroll down and tell you about her. She's a environmental health data equity strategist for the Oregon Health Authority. But she wrote this op-ed for this publication entitled The Common Ground Between Labor and Climate Justice is the Key to a Livable Future. And we can link this in the show notes. But I got to it just by sort of searching around for that idea of when unions do things, unions divorced from climate awareness, right? Because our experience in a union at Vox Media Union, it was like socially and environmentally conscious, right? The work that we were doing definitely had an environmental impact, but a lot of what the union was doing specifically, you know, trying to get better restrictions on AI and stuff that we knew was wasteful and stupid and bad for the environment.
Yeah.
We knew that most of us were on the same side there, but you know, there are not every union works in a field that has less of an environmental impact, right? Like there are pipelines, right? There are oil pipelines and those workers are unionized.
Right.
You know, there are factories that make stuff that becomes e-waste that, you know, causes problems, that, you know, there are factories that make stuff that goes directly into the trash after it's used. So it's not always the union's general concern or primary concern is usually the well-being of its employees. But this is a cool article that goes into the overlap of union organizing and environmentalism. And the one thing that I wanted to pull out, which was really cool to me, and I didn't know this. In 1948, the U.S. Steel's Denora Zinc Works and the American Steel and Wire plants filled with smog the air of the industrial town Denora in Pennsylvania. The heavy layer of pollution killed 20 people and caused long-term health effects for at least 5,900 people. The U.S. Steel Corporation denied responsibility and instead claimed the incident was an act of God. The United Steelworkers Union, whose members and families were among the primary victims, pushed for a federal investigation into the incident. The union's continued advocacy paved the way for the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, OSHA regulations, Superfund laws, and the Toxic Substances Control Act, and climate change legislation. There's also a big case in the 60s where UAW was spearheading some labor environmentalism even before the birth of the mainstream environmental movement. There absolutely is an overlap of labor and environmentalism, and I think the way I think of it is like, it seems to me like looking at it that like generally if you are organized within a labor space, you are also looking at the longevity of that space and the sustainability of that thing, because you as the worker, you know, if you clear cut the fields are going to be out of work.
Right.
And while the people who invested the money in that and reaped the money of that can move on to the next exploitable resource, you can't. Your fields are fallow and your trees are all cut down.
Yeah.
So generally, like, self-interest is a motivating factor, but like then there are cases like there are union-made bombs, right? Like,
yeah.
How do you reckon with that?
Yeah. I don't know how we reckon with that. I literally don't have an answer to that. But like Pat, like the whole excerpt that you're reading from is like, wow, it's almost as if the EPA is important. Like, damn.
Oh yeah. We should keep that thing.
We should keep that.
Oh God. So I just started reading Blood in the Machine, that book about the Luddites.
Yeah.
And it feels like it's going to become a bit more of that, but a big point of why the Luddites were successful in trying to stop factory work at the time was not just because they felt like they're protecting jobs, but like the factories became a source of pollution. It was not like a thing people liked having near them. So in addition to being like, this is taking lots of jobs, this is also causing problems. So there is, it has obviously evolved since then, and how many ways the buck can be passed to someone else, the problems, to how much farther down the line their causes are. But yeah, generally I would think and hope that a organization, a union designed to keep its own workplace, you know, going for the benefit of its members and the benefits of its craft, is also caring about the environment in which its people live in and the people who want to use that, what their services they provide. It does feel like it needs to be core to that kind of like theory of being.
Yeah. If only for your own self-preservation.
Right.
Like, there's no profit on a dead planet, guys. Like, come on.
Yeah.
And now, so to transition back to the world of pat labor a little bit for a minute, out of this article, the author does say that unfortunately, shifts in the U.S. economy and corporate backlash in the 70s hindered longstanding environmental vision for unions. In the mid 70s, oil price spike exposed economic vulnerabilities. And then the Reagan administration obviously comes in and makes things a lot worse for unions and austerity in general. And in that time, right, like, you know, as we say, there's no profit on a dead planet. Like, that's the time where it's like, well, we need food, so we're going to put this other stuff. We're going to think about that stuff in the future, right?
Yeah. Somebody will figure that out in the future. Somebody. Yeah.
And there is a line in this episode of Pat Labor that makes me think that we're sort of in that world. And it was maybe my first, like, are we the baddies? Or not my first, but it was a
sort of at least watching this show.
Yeah.
It was a sort of Verhoeven-esque, like, are we the baddies moment where Shinohara is being explained what this environmental terrorist group is. He's like, what is a terrorist network? And his coworker responds, it's one of those groups where they table their differences and philosophies to join forces and accomplish their goals. You know, a terrorist group, yeah, which is so fucking funny.
It's like, wait, aren't you describing a union?
Exactly.
But,
yes.
But in the sub, it says like a terrorist mutual aid society. I'm like,
yes, that was immaculate commentary. Like, it was such a good joke. It made me believe that, like, this is, I mean, there's actually another really great joke here that you pointed out, Toussaint, in this scene that has to do with a completely different thing, but it is the new character, Sergeant Clancy.
Yeah. I watched it in the English dub, and then I watched it in the Japanese subtitle version, right? Just because I wanted to, like, compare notes between, like, what is being said and what is being transcribed in other ways like that, right? And I didn't remember this when I watched it through the English dub, but I definitely got this the second time with the Japanese, like, subtitles, is that Clancy can speak both Japanese and English. And that is why, like, SV2 is clapping. It's not just because she's a pretty girl. It's not just because there's a woman here who's
they
not
are hooting
Noah.
And hollering.
They're just hollering, like, what's your number? I'm just like, do you have any sisters? I'm just like, she's
but it's just about her fluency. It's just about how good she is.
Well, I think it's also because she's a babe.
That too. But also, it's fluency.
Yeah. In the dub I watch, she introduces herself in Japanese, and everyone goes, "Wow, Japanese!" And they're clapping. And then she introduces herself in English, and everyone goes, "Oh, English!" Really, really good.
So
she is here is a liaison for the mayor. The mayor is coming into Tokyo. And they are concerned that one of these specific environmental terror groups called Beach House, which is a fucking awesome name for an environmental terrorist group,
the
is
most
planning
extreme
an attack.
One. That's the,
like,
most
get
extreme.
Around, yeah, get
the
around, most extreme. I get around.
Beach House is the first environmental group to advocate taking up arms to, achieve
direct
their
action.
Goals.
Yeah.
Isn't that
how to blow up a Pat Labor?
Yeah.
I'm glad that you got that joke.
I got you.
Yeah.
So the crew is put on a security detail for the mayor's visit as he comes to visit Tokyo. There's a nice shot of them eating not McDonald's inside a van.
I was wondering if anybody else would catch the McDonald's appearance.
Yeah.
So I feel like this is a fun thing to just describe for people who maybe don't watch a ton of anime. So McDonald's has been apparently around since, according to this Fast Company article, 1981 from a franchise manga first called Cat's Eye.
Ooh.
And then eventually appeared in the TV series. And apparently since then, it has been common in dozens and dozens of animes and movies, TV series, because it's a way to, like, have a brand and avoid copyright. Like, it is clearly McDonald's. Often it's the same colors. Sometimes it's blue. Here it's notably the blue version. Mm-hmm. But all it is taking the M and flipping it upside down. And then people call it WickDonald's, WackDonald's. There's kind of different ways it's sometimes spelled out. But it's just a fun joke. Eventually, McDonald's turned into an ad thing. So right. Now it's not
as fun. I think, honestly, it was to create, like, a sense of verisimilitude within each respective universe, and also a not so subtle way of trying to escape the eye of Sauron that was, like, McDonald's, like copyright
infringement,
copyright infringement force. I'm just like, you need to run that by us first.
My first time catching it was some Gundam series where I just loved seeing the menu wrote out hamburgers.
Yep.
Like, yep. I'm real hungry to get a hamburger at McDonald's.
It also just makes sense for this specific episode of the show, but also the era, right? This is the era where, I think globalization was...
Yes.
Pushing our fast food burgers out to other places. And I don't know how thoroughly penetrated into the Japanese market it was in the early 90s, late 80s when this anime was made. But definitely in the year that Pat Labor takes place in, the far-flung year of whatever it was, 98 or something like that.
Yeah.
They would be sitting in a van eating McDonald's.
Exactly. They also, this is something I noticed because it's interesting where they use the WickDonald's thing here. But I think after we have the like intermission graphic, which we didn't have that last episode, did we? Or did I completely forget it?
I don't recall. Yeah.
But this is a series that halfway through they have a little commercial like outro intro thing.
Oh, you mean the eye catches. Yeah, that's like a common.
Is that what it's called? Thank you. I knew there must be a term for it.
Yeah, eye catches are a common thing, especially in Japanese anime, because I think it's literally required almost on a legal level in order to differentiate like between what is the actual programming and what is like the actual like advertisement block. Yeah.
Full Metal Alchemist.
Full Metal Alchemist. Alchemist. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We got to get one of those for the pod.
We do.
Oh, yeah.
We do. When we switch over to the labor of Pat's labor. Labor.
Yeah. But I think that the scene like right out of the eye catch is the airport. And I just noted here that they use the actual brand and logo for ANA, Tokyo Air, and Korean Air. And I was just like, that was interesting.
Yeah.
Maybe they're just less scared of them.
But like they had the verisimilitude there. So the feet, again, seems very 1998, except for all the robots standing around. Mm-hmm.
Such a wonderful touch here. Such a wonderfully Pat Labor touch here when they show the airport or the hotel where the mayor will be staying at. They point out, not super relevant to the plot, but it's just important to the world of Pat Labor that his flight was delayed.
Yes.
Everything in this world is delayed. I love it.
His flight was delayed. Like, there's all types of protests. There's traffic.
There's
always traffic jams in the world of Pat Labor. It fucking sucks. You can't get anywhere. There are riots everywhere. Everyone's pissed off and trying to get somewhere. I love that.
In this one, it's a bomb threat is the thing that delays the flight initially, and then the plane just has mechanical problems.
Yes, right.
Unrelated.
Right.
Yeah. And also, the main kind of tension so far at this point is boredom. Like, they're just bored because they are the quintessential cops on duty. They even get yelled at, a couple of them, by some people in traffic who are just like, I forget exactly what they say, but it's something like, get off your lazy asses, or like, because they are just sitting there because nothing's happening. There's just traffic. It's just.
Mm-hmm. What's the Lord Byron quote that I first learned about from an episode of Justice League Unlimited? They also serve who only stand and wait. Like, that's kind of like the whole mentality of that. I'm not trying to like come off as like more hoity-toity than I am. I was like, no, I literally learned a Lord Byron quote from watching a Saturday morning cartoon show.
Incredible.
You can learn a lot of shit from cartoons, guys.
That's true.
Yeah, look at us.
Yeah. Look at us.
It becomes another hurry up and wait thing, a nice little slice of life thing. It's them waiting in a car. It's Shinohara looking for a bathroom after eating his McDonald's and stumbling across an old lady who asks him what a trailer is that's sitting out in the middle of this park. And he says, that's a mobile command center. And I got to go to the bathroom. And that will come back later.
This shit-eating granny, literally incredible. Just like stunning his face. Like, oh, are you going to move that over there? Oh, you're not? Oh, okay.
They also, geographically interesting, like right behind them in this scene is Tokyo City Hall. That's what like that two tower building is.
Yeah. And that's what got me fucked up, because it's like, wait a minute, that's the Diet building? I'm just like, am I missing something? That's the Tokyo Metropolitan Government building, as I remember that from Digimon Tamers. I remember that shit from Digimon Tamers. And then I looked up the National Diet building. I'm just like, wait a minute, that's an whole other fucking place in the city. Like, yeah.
So I'm pretty sure the thing here is, once again, the team one has got the important detail. Yeah. They're actually there where the mayor is in the mayor's meeting. Yeah. They're on the thing, like, watch the building they're not at yet.
Yeah.
So I think that's partly, again, the like, I don't know if it's going to be a common trope, but like the team two gets all the annoying, boring jobs, or the other team gets the exciting ones.
Are we ever going to meet team one? I don't know. I got to look up team one. I was just like, are we ever going to meet these dudes who are like the top of the top? Like, who the hell are they? Like, yeah.
Yeah. Cause I mean, in terms of like characters we've met, we have only met their commanding officer, right? We haven't seen a lineup of the good counterparts of our sort of second rate characters. There is a little character moment that I really loved where they are showing all the police sleeping together in a little tiny cramped room during their duty. And it's the moment where you see Oda sleeping. And so Oda is the really like aggro, like he's the character we described as he wants to be a character in another mecha anime.
Right.
And he's sleeping and his trigger finger is just twitching in his dream.
He is like, hold it. I'm just like, dude, can you just calm the fuck down?
They need to
get
this guy off the force.
They need him to go for a long walk. He's got to go through a psyche eval. I'm like, we
so many bad signs, red flags.
There's also another one where like Gota is dreaming of kissing Shinobu. He's like the head of the SV-1. Is like, that's the first time that it hints that like he has some sort of romantic inclination for Shinobu. Yeah.
And he's kissing one of his coworkers' feet, actually. Because they're all just like... head to foot jammed into this room together.
And before they go to sleep, they're all like, it's fun because this feels another, the crew late together, working late. They're trying to get a like dinner delivery order. Somebody's like, I think it ends up being Izumi is finally like, oh, fine, I'll take the order.
Yeah.
And, our wife guy gets his like,
underwear.
He
gets his underwear from his wife. I'm just like, man, that's wild.
But then next day, we finally get to, I guess, the climactic action.
Yes.
Which is not what you might expect. Empty streets, high security. Yes. There's like men in black everywhere. The team is either really tired or just completely wired. And Asuma realizes this is the point where they're just kind of having a talk about why they didn't get their own mobile command unit. This is when it suddenly occurs to him, wait a minute. We don't have the resources to have any of those.
No,
we would never have one. I totally had an argument with an old lady about one the other day.
Yeah.
Yes.
Light bulb goes off. He takes Izumi. They are running to get there because he realizes I missed a really bad thing. There's been a bomb threat. They kind of confirm this over the phone that like, oh yeah, there was another bomb threat and it was in a trailer. So definitely go look into that. But they can't get there.
Yes. Now, before we get to this important thing.
Oh.
I just want to point out an extremely important Captain Gota line. That's the name of their captain, right?
Yeah.
Their captain, yes.
Right. Shinohara is sitting in the top of his van, and he's looking very, very, very sleepy. And what he's told by his commanding officer, Gota, is sleep if you want, but do it with your eyes open.
Yeah.
There's no telling who could be snapping pictures, which is such a perfect encapsulation of that character's ethos as a man, as a commanding officer. He doesn't care that you're sleeping, he cares that you get caught.
Yep. Don't make us look bad, whatever.
Yes. So Clayton, and back to you, they are running to the bomb site.
It's an action sequence. It's fast, it's kinetic, the music is loud, but there's a bridge in the way that the Pat Labor can either go climb under or get over. It's just the most annoying height for them, and it's just like, what do we do? But we have a great idea from Izuma, where there's been this blimp in the air a couple times, so this wasn't like completely out of this blue for this episode, but he basically points up at it with his like a loudspeaker and just starts yelling, whoever you're in that, I'm requisitioning you by the official Pat Labor division. We need your help to move a Pat Labor, and you know, we're gonna use the blimp for you to like get over this bridge. You're gonna fly. We're gonna make a Pat Labor fly just like in your dream. And the main thing I loved about this is both the way they edit this whole instance, this little piece of logistics is like a big mecha action battle scene. Like that is the vibe of it. But I love the part where the blimp pilot, which is just this like, I don't know, kind of classic American pilot. It feels like big mustache. And his co-pilot's like, "Are you insane? What are we doing?" And he's like, "I've always wanted to do something like this. It's
so good. I don't care if I lose my license." I'm like, dude.
And then, you know, the Pat Labor literally just like grabs in. You see the gigantic fingers like crushing the cockpit thing. It barely glides over. She has to do a running jump and then like lift herself underneath the blimp to just barely get over. And then basically just falls off and is like lying on the ground. And then you see this wide shot. They accomplished moving this thing like 50 feet.
It's such it is a pure comedy shot because the blimp is drifting away and the robot is just laying stiffly on its back on the other side of the bridge. It rocks.
All it's that so effort good. For just like how many inches? How many fucking feet?
Like 50 inches in robot size, 50 feet. It was just so funny. Yeah, but then, now they're there. They're at the trailer. It's now, like, I think it opens up, and now it's clearly not just, like, a trailer. It's full of rockets. It's like a missile launcher.
Now, I love this touch, just as, like, a more interesting than a bomb thing. It's just, like, having a trailer that opens, and it's a full fucking battery of rocket launchers.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
And they want to specifically shoot at the mayor's helicopter as it lands at the building. So that's why it's there.
Yeah.
And we get some more details about the fact that the other kind of decoy thing was literally another thing like this, another rocket pod, but it was a decoy. It was intentionally a fake. So they're like, "You have the real one. You have to stable it." And we get another kind of Oda scene that's great, because a similar vibe to him is when they discover what this is and they're like, "This is going to be really difficult to disarm, but we got to do it. If you're not careful with it, it could explode. But we're definitely not calling off the mayor who's 10 minutes away when we totally could, because that would look bad.
That would dishonor the entire department, and you got to just figure it out."
That's what he's like. Just figure it out.
Just figure it out. That's what it is.
His motivation is, I'll let Izumi do it if you can't figure it out.
Right, yeah.
But he has help. And this is also kind of, this is the scene we get that's, this is actually genuinely a bit more like action hero intensity. Mm, right. They have Clancy on the phone, and she is going to be their bomb, because she also happens to have the skill set. She is a bomb disposal expert. So she's on the radio with Azuma and Izumi. And so the first thing is, okay, you're going to have to take off the back of it, but, you know, be very careful. If this thing jiggles too much or something happens to it, it shakes, it could blow up. Very next scene, the Pat Labor rips off the metal backing and tosses it to the side.
It is so funny. I just love that, like, even though, like, there's a joke to it, they're also like, the labor does kind of need something to do in this episode.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
It's like, well, they'll remove the back panel of the launcher.
Yeah.
And then there's underneath it, there's a whole fake, massive fake mechanism. Mm-hmm.
It's really cool. Like, as far as your, you know, greebled up anime machinery kind of animation, it's sick. Mm. It's also literally a decoy. It means nothing.
This is, funny. This is totally of a time where, like, you just get the absolute sicko on your team to, like, do some intricate, speculative, like, mechanical animation, and they just totally go off. I'm just like, it was for nothing other than their own enjoyment. I'm like, fuck yeah. I'm glad.
I mean, it's kind of beautiful that they literally do it to make the joke that actually that is distraction. Ignore that.
Yeah.
The actual thing is a little tiny panel underneath. So he's down there. I mean, it's your classic. There's a bunch of wires. You clip this one, unhook this thing. Be very careful when you unscrew this part. It's great. And then we get down to the final two.
The final two. And I loved this so much.
I can't believe I've never seen something actually like this in a bomb defusal sequence.
Yeah. Me neither.
Like, I was trying to think, has anyone ever just done this? Which is literally, you get down to red and blue, and she's just like, okay, you've got a red one and a blue one, right? And he's like, yep. Okay, which is your favorite color? He's like, red?
It reminded me of, like, okay, like, kind of a far afield reference, but this is like, it reminded me of the first level of Deus Ex Human Revolution, where, like, there's, like, a compound gas bomb, and it turns out the way to disable it, you don't just have to hack it. You can just shoot one of the canisters, and the bomb will deactivate. Because that's also how the bomb, like, that bomb model works in real life. I'm like, what the fuck? Are you serious? I could just shoot it? I'm like, that's crazy.
Man. Yeah, it's So she explains that, like, okay, one of these is a grounding wire. The other one is the trigger wire attached to the timer. The only person who knows which is the person who made the bomb. So you got a 50-50 chance. Just cut the one that you want.
Yeah. Flip of a coin. And he, look, he's really nervous. He can't do it. He's like going back and forth. This is when he says the line, what's that thing you Americans say when it's like really risky and you have a no chance, but you do it anyway? And she's like, long shot?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They said the name. They said the name of the episode.
But he, I guess, gets his ass saved because he's really thinking about the blue wire. Long time on the blue wire, about to do it. Then he's like, no, he goes to the red wire and he's about to do it. And then another wire clipper comes in from off camera and clips the blue wire. Obviously, nothing happens. And Clancy got there just in the nick of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
yeah.
Also, she just chose. It would have. Didn't mean anything necessarily, but it was a good like resolution to it. What is clearly going to be a character dynamic between the two of them.
Mm-hmm. And then then Shinohara's a hero against his wishes, because he is in the days after this event. He is just so unbelievably strung up and like strung out and unable to come down from the terror of maybe nearly being exploded underneath this thing. And he's talking about his resignation and quitting. And even though everyone's like, hey, great job on that bomb thing, he's like, he doesn't feel like he did anything because he got saved at the last minute. And then we get the exciting news that Sergeant Kanuka Clancy is going to be joining them in a 1-year exchange. And he changes his mind and says, I am staying.
You know that thing I said? Forget it.
One thing I did like about like that like last scene is that they show the perp picture of the old woman. And just like her name is Ine the Gadget Ito, age 72. She's like a demolitions expert and a known terrorist with like, I don't know how many credits of like demolition things going on. I'm just like, I kind of want this character to come back, if only for for them to get thrown into jail. I'm just like, that'd be fun. Yeah.
No, she rocks.
Also, I noted in this scene, there's just a book on the table that says gun.
Ah, gun.
That's gun. All it says.
Yeah. Read the manual.
The gun manual.
Yeah.
This was such a fun episode.
Mm-hmm.
It had even more of what I thought from how people described it, but didn't realize how much hit the nail on the head. It's like it's satirizing it a little bit, the genre. It is poking fun at it in incredible ways, where it's about like how the medium presents robot mecha and using that to make it these really good jokes. And I'm so excited for more stuff like that.
This was
the first one where I felt that, again, my biggest point of reference for it is always Paul Verhoeven, but like that Paul Verhoeven tone of like, oh, this is not necessarily valorizing these guys.
No.
Right? Like it is placing them in a world where they are not necessarily acting in everybody's best interest, or they are doing their job within a corrupt system or a system that is harmful.
Right. Or at least like, benignly malicious in some extent. Like they're really just upholding the status quo, but then like what is exactly that status quo? You're not necessarily fascist. You're just like, look, man, I'm just showing up to work. I'm making the donuts. I'm doing what I need to do. I don't care where the donuts go. I'm just making them. Okay. It's what it is.
The least worst thing you could do is stand there and play Bejeweled, I suppose.
Right. Yeah.
But the characters aren't awake to that world, right?
Like
our main character doesn't know what Beach House is or why these people are upset.
He doesn't give a shit because he was forced to take this job from his dad. Yeah, that's really what it is.
What I like here is that I'm, you know, realizing he's the audience stand in a bit, because he's going to be the person who helpfully gets everything explained to him along with us. But he's also, that's a character trait. And I liked how that came up when he describes like, I never wanted this job. And Oda is really offended. He's like, take that back, basically. And he's like, make me. And it's going to be a thing with him, I feel, that he truly does not care about this job. He is doing it because he had to. Whereas you have people like Oda and even Izumi for different reasons who love this job.
Yeah.
I did, because you brought up Verhoeven, I did just want to say one thing that are just throw this out there because I know this is once again a series that's hard to watch, but I found one that is for the time being easy to watch on YouTube.
Mm.
There is a Starship Troopers OVA from 1988.
What? Ooh.
That I am definitely going to watch once I discover it. But we had a discussion on the episode zero about how Starship Troopers design, the like robot mecha from the books, not the movie. The books were more like a mecha suit.
Yeah.
And that's what's in this cartoon or the anime, which is really interesting. And so the idea that like this is 1988. So it is long after that inspiration has always already influenced robot mech or anime mecha themselves. And it's, I'm super curious to see what I've read out there is apparently a very true to the book description, but just seeing anime Rico is so funny to me.
Yeah. I've got, I've got two notes. One, it's not Lord Byron. It was John Milton. My apologies. That's where the quote comes
from. Thank you for the end episode correction.
And two, Pat, you said you had another article you wanted to like refer back to that was about blimps.
This one is sort of a red herring.
Yeah, please.
I was searching. I was like, is there a blimp pilot union?
Yes, I want to know.
I couldn't find out, but
like all five of them.
I got really excited because I found a New York Times article from 1919, and I was like, okay, wait, this has, it was called Union of Engineers, the Origin of Blimp. And I got so excited about the organ, how the labor unions would have been involved in the creation of the blimp. But it turns out it's just about, it's a New York Times article about like some people doing road construction in New York City unionizing, and then it's the letters to the editor section, so they're bundled together in the same article. Then there's, so it's like, okay, it is extremely timely in view of the fact that the engineers of the Public Service Commission have recently organized the Rapid Transit Engineers Association. Much agitation has been carried on to have the association affiliate with the American Federation of Labor, and it's illuminating to have Mrs. Atherton, from her vast experience, advocate affiliation. So it's just somebody writing a letter to the editor about some transit group organizing. And then there's just attached to the same letters to the editor, it says, to the editor of the New York Times, blimp is an old English word meaning blister. I think it must be of local origin, for I cannot find mentioned in Webster. So it's just somebody like writing in to tell them what the origin of the word blimp is.
You literally just looked it up in a dictionary. It's like, this sounds like something that I should write to the editor. I'm like, what? Like,
there's a little more. He does say, I cannot find it mentioned in Webster, but a large blister has been called a blimp for time immemorial. Doubtless airmen saw some fancied resemblance to a blister, and with their fancy for original nomenclature, christened the fantastic shapes of observation balloons blimps. Don't know if that's true, but it was in an article in the New York Times in 1919.
Yeah, so. Yeah. That means it must be true.
And actually, hang on.
If you want more blimp content, there's a pretty good 99% invisible episode about it. I mean,
blimps are 99% invisible because it's all the air in there, right?
Damn. Damn. Got him.
How did we feel about this episode overall? And how do we feel about our journey through Pat Labor?
I like it. It's very, very interesting. I love the introduction of a new character. I love the bureaucracy. I love how inconvenient this universe is to robots, and yet they're like, nah, we need them for this massive like public works project. Like, we got to make this shit work somehow.
That stuff I was really intrigued by. The both the fact that this world has something else in it that I guess is kind of sci-fi, a giant ocean wall, but also like the New York City mayor just comes for a visit. Like, it's very, it feels a bit also like 90s end of history. There's not actually that much geopolitical going on, because this wasn't apparently that other than this very directly related environmental terror movement, I suppose.
Yeah,
because it feels like that's not going away either.
I did look up, like, was this a reference to any like particular like thing that happened during the 80s, and I'm just like, no, there was like one incident where like the mayor of New York like visited like Tokyo, and he like talked shit about the previous mayor, and that was apparently a whole kerfluffle, because you're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to do that. I'm like, what a halcyon time.
I think it was at the end. I mean, when we found out Sergeant Clancy was going to become a character, I feel like it was mostly her coattails that were like, oh, we need her storyline to have the mayor. Mm-hmm. And then it was so funny that it's like, well, the mayor's just here for a luncheon. Like, that's it. It's not actually that big a deal.
She just She happened to be there, and it happened to coincide with this thing going on. It's like, well, if you're going to be going on this year-long thing anyway, you might as well just be working the security detail for the mayor. And that's kind of like, it ties back to like Asuma's like whole assumption of, be like, something's going on here. Why is this person coming in here and like doing this stuff? I'm just like, it's because she was here for a work study thing for a year. And like,
and I have to imagine there's something to, like, for better or worse, I'd probably vote worse, but the NYPD is probably the most known police department.
Yeah.
Outside of its own city. Like, mm-hmm. That's usually not the case, but just because of popular culture, media, literally how big it is. I think there's like points out there that it's the fourth largest land army or something.
Yeah.
But it is, her character trait was she is NYPD. And I think that was probably the thing. There's kind of also an interesting thing there where she mentions that, like, oh, we recently did a terrorist, or I recently defused a bomb like this up for something in LA. So, like, I guess she's also going around the country with her expertise, yeah. But.
Damn, she's cool as fuck.
She works for the LA branch of the NYPD.
What? Yeah.
I did remember one incredible diplomatic visit to Japan.
Oh, yes. Happened later. Had it happened yet?
It had. When did the show come out?
When did this episode come out? Because they're 88, so it could have.
88. Ooh, yeah, they missed it by 4 years. Shit.
Yeah.
The 1992 George H.W. Bush vomiting incident had not yet occurred at the time that this episode came out, in which, while attending a banquet hosted by Japanese Prime Minister Keiichi Miyazawa on January 8th, 1992, President George H.W. Bush fainted after vomiting into Miyazawa's trousers.
He just like leans over.
Yeah.
That's just wild. Yarts is on his lap.
Jesus.
Oh, man. Remember when this was like what we, the best that, or like the worst that we had to deal with? No, it wasn't right. We had to deal with.
Right. It's like so mortifying. I was like, oh, we'll never live this down. I'm like,
embarrassing ourselves.
Stay tuned. Stay tuned for coming attractions. Yeah.
And stay tuned for more episodes of Pat's Labor. We appreciate everybody who joined us on our first episodes, especially those who subscribed to rogue.site and got themselves access to that episode zero. Just a reminder, you can do that. Also, I believe if you subscribe to a higher level, you also get our video podcasts, which we do. We'll have a little extra content here afterwards for the people who watch those. And we also just appreciate the people who read the site. There is, I think, a lot of great stuff on there already from our contributors, or our writers and founders, Ryan, Cass, Alice, and Jeffrey. Mm-hmm. We even have a couple commissioned pieces from Polygon Names, you might remember. And I think even more to come. So just be on the lookout. But check out rogue.site, subscribe. There's a free subscription level, so you can get access to a ton of stuff that way. And we appreciate you being a part of this.
Thank you, everybody.
I'm Tucson Egan.
I'm Patrick Gill.
Damn it, we gotta figure out an order.
We gotta figure out
We'll get it next time.
All right,
until next time.
Stay tuned. Yeah.